Good evening, everyone. Good evening. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters, and we're going to shift some paradigms tonight with our guests, Pearl Mast and David Omick. And I'm on tour, as many of you know. I've been traveling in the wonderful, dry but beautiful Southwest Arizona area, and with my friend Sue, who has horses. And lo and behold, these people pulled in with their pickup truck, and what they were picking up is horse apples. So welcome to the show, David and Pearl, and we'll find out more about horse apples, which is, that's kind of a euphemism for horse poo. Probably most of you know that. So welcome to the show, Pearl. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Now, I want to know all about what you were doing. You had a sieve. There's a big barrel, and there was a sieve, and you are both with, of course, well-gloved hands. Tell us what you were doing.
Well, fortunately, the horse apples were pretty much dry already.
In this environment. Yeah.
That's right. And we were preparing a cover material for our composting toilet.
Aha. Uh-huh. What do you mean cover material?
Well, the toilet requires, it composts human waste. And human waste is high in nitrogen, so there's a lot of carbon that's required. So we were looking for a material that's high in carbon, high in fiber, and noticed that horses have chopped up their hay into very fine pieces when they pass it through their digestive system, and when it's dried out, it works very well as a carbon source for the toilet.
Ah, that's great. So you're out here and you're living in this absolutely beautiful little, what was it, a bread truck?
Right.
And for people at home, you'd be really startled if you could see how beautiful this is, with the beautiful wood and the excellent layout. And these two are living, you call it sustainability or living. Is it permaculture, sustainability?
I would say relatively simple living. We try to live as much as we can in integrated into the environment we live in here.
Mm.
So part of that local environment involves horses, and as you saw yesterday, we were making use of something they were producing.
I remember studying a little bit of permaculture, and they said you use everything three times. Everything has at least three uses, right?
We incorporate a lot of permaculture principles here. Yeah, I wouldn't say we're permaculturists, but we definitely appreciate the philosophy. Yeah.
Well, I'm very impressed at your layout here, where you actually cook in here, and you cook in your solar oven, mm-hmm. and you have your, maybe you should talk about your shower. You want to talk about your shower and your dishwashing and...
Well, we decided that we wanted to try to keep our indoor space as small as possible and mm-hmm. enjoy the outdoors.
Mm.
So basically the things that you listed were a lot of the activities that involve water,
mm-hmm.
and those all happen outside. Now, we can do that fairly easily here in this climate, even throughout the year. But in addition to that, we have the solar oven, which we use on a regular basis, and
that's enough. I mean, you can use the solar oven. Of course you can. You've got tremendous sunshine here.
Even in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
Our solar oven will go up to about 425 degrees even in the winter time.
Oh, really?
So
does it cook as fast as another oven might be?
It definitely does. On a good sunny day, it will sometimes be too hot for certain things that I want to do.
Wow. So you do your cooking outside, and you do your cleaning up, and you're showering outside. And, of course, mm-hmm. before I forget, we need to get back to the compost toilet, because people are interested in that. You know, this whole thing about human waste is a huge project, isn't it, when you're trying to be in sync with the land. So tell us about it. Yours is very beautiful. It's all surrounded by bamboo and
got a
good view.
a cheap toilet with a wonderful view. Yes, a million-dollar view.
But it isn't just that it's a cheap toilet. It's a really...
I should say inexpensive. Yeah.
Yeah. But isn't it an amazing way to take care of a big
problem? It is. And
problem?
Actually, you know, we've several times already used the word waste. And actually, we don't really think of it as waste.
Good, okay.
To us, it's a resource.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a, I think, a transformative way of thinking about something that generally we would rather not think about at all,
mm-hmm.
Particularly in our society.
And yet it could cause huge problems in our society.
Yeah,
the
normal
sewage structure.
Yes. Composting is an almost miraculously transformative process.
Mm.
We often have tour groups, college groups, and so forth coming here, and we show them around. And we often, fairly early when we're showing them around, show them the composting toilet. And then at the very end, we show them what happens with that compost later on in the cycle. And we think of it very much as a cycle. Later on in the cycle, the compost is actually growing vegetables.
Oh, what, you're kidding. Okay.
We eat throughout the winter, and the vegetables grow like they're on steroids.
Hmm.
It's just amazing that you can take a product that, in modern technological society, we're typically thinking of ways to get rid of. And
you think salmonella, you think of all kinds of illnesses,
right.
The bacteria, and so on. Yeah.
And what happens in the composting process is that there is such intense microbial competition that these pathogens can't survive in that environment.
Oh, wow.
And so it becomes a very safe product. And we've been doing this for more than 20 years now.
Really?
We've never been sick. Certainly not from that. We get colds like everyone else does, but we certainly never had those other types of illnesses.
But it's remarkable to think that you could have a compost toilet and then use the leftover is not leftover. You get to put it back in the land.
That's right. And it really is very much, as I mentioned, a cyclical process. I mean, we eat the food, we digest it, it goes into the toilet, it's composted. It becomes a growing medium for new food to grow, plants to grow. We eat the plants. The cycle's completed.
Round and round. So what happens with the horse apple?
So,
at which part of the cycle does it go in?
Okay, so when you're finished using a composting toilet, instead of flushing, you simply put in some dry carbonaceous material. In this case, the sifted horse manure, right. Right, and it makes a wonderful cover material.
Oh, wow.
Balances out the nitrogen and makes
microbes
happy.
Probably prevents the smell and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's very impressive. So who are you two? Like, how did you get into living? You've lived like this for, what, 20 years, did you say?
Yeah.
And before that, David, I haven't asked Pearl yet, but have you lived on sailboats a lot of the time?
I did. When I was younger, I did a lot of sailing and got used to living in small spaces. Have always just been drawn to that. It suits me. Yeah.
And how did you learn about, like, for example, the composting toilet? Surely you didn't use those on a sailboat, but...
No.
Did you just...
I do a lot of reading. I try to research what others have done rather than trying to reinvent the wheel, see what's been done elsewhere, and then try to adapt it to my own local situation.
Hmm. But you must have, what did you come from? Did you come from a ranch, or did you come from the land, or
no,
did you come from the ocean, dolphin land?
I grew up generally in cities and towns. My father was a college professor, I grew up just in sort of the normal American lifestyle.
Was he teaching biology or farming?
English literature.
Oh, you're kidding.
As far from that as you could get.
Well, I guess there's some exploration in that, isn't there?
There is, actually. And he used to talk a lot about that. Yeah.
Is he impressed with what you're doing? Have they learned a lot about what you're doing?
He passed away several years ago, but yes, I would say he was.
Yeah, because it takes a certain kind of vigorous focus and learning to live the way you're living successfully. Right?
Yeah, and it does, and I think he appreciated that. Yeah.
That's great. And what about you, Pearl?
In terms of
well, you're very obviously very very knowledgeable in all this and foods as well. You told me when I first met you that you had been raised in a Mennonite household.
That's right.
So
that was back in Delaware, and of course we had huge gardens and did a lot of canning and freezing of food. So that aspect of our life has been very familiar. But otherwise, I would say it was fairly, aside from the religious aspect, it was fairly typical in terms of our household economy, et cetera. I guess the composting toilets actually come in a little bit in meeting David. He was just, when I met him, he was just building his very first one.
Oh, really?
And I was totally fascinated with the idea. And he was also building his first solar oven. And
I knew I had a keeper at that point.
Well, you're a nurse, so I mean, was that kind of a jump to go from a scientific nursing background into this kind of a background? Or you're kind of curious anyway, right?
No, I don't really think it was that much of a jump. And in fact, it takes science to do these things. For example, the solar oven that we have, well, maybe I should call it math. One of our neighbors did some fairly elaborate, who is a mathematician, did some fairly elaborate equations to determine the exact angle that the mirror should be so that all of the sun, the rays of the sun are reflected into the box.
Oh, wonderful. Okay.
So, no, I would say that it's definitely not an unscientific way of living.
What about comfort? Did you have to adjust? Did you have to get comfortable and live in a smaller environment, or were you always in a smallish environment?
I wasn't always in a smallish environment, but somehow I seem to take to it naturally.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that we had sacrificed very little comfort. I don't like being uncomfortable. I do not like being cold at all, as David can attest. And so I feel like one of our purposes has been to figure out how to live comfortably on a smaller scale and on a simpler scale.
Do you think it's just like an inner passion to want to be able to evolve in terms of living in sync with the land or in the flow of the land?
That's probably a fairly good way of expressing it. Right.
It's much greater than a hobby. It's a much more of a beingness.
It is, right. It's it feels very satisfying. And particularly for me, I realize the longer we do it, the more I realize how much the connection with the land and the sky and so on around
wildlife.
Me, how much it, and the wildlife, how important that is to me. When I get up in the morning, no matter how cold it is, I'm very anxious to step outside and be able to look around and feel that connection with the outside. So to me, the indoor living space is, I view that as sometimes I picture it more like a cloak than a space to walk, rather than a space to live within. It's more like something to draw around me for protection, but it isn't. But the outdoors is, in some ways, just as much home
That's
as
nice,
the inside is.
Now, has it taken like 20 years for you to develop that sensitivity, or has it always been like that for you, or either of you?
I wouldn't say it's taken 20 years, but it certainly, I think it's only increased with time rather than something that I've gotten tired of.
So an emerging, kind of an emerging awareness or something?
Perhaps.
So around here, where I've met these wonderful people is in Cascabel, which is Cascabel Valley, just outside of Tucson or by the...
Cascabel in the San Pedro River Valley.
Okay, the San Pedro River Valley.
Yep.
It's very beautiful here. The people here, is there a lot of this? Could you tell us about what gatherings go on here and whether you have a lot of support? Do you have a support on the national level as well?
I would say we do have a lot of support, say, for the way we live, and also for just in general, people out here appreciating the really unique place we do live.
There's a lot of space here and a lot of people that are stepping away from the kind of hubbub and the...
That's right. Very true. Yeah. So there are quite a few people out here who are in, you know, various stages of exploring different ways of living.
Self-actualizing who you are and all that.
Yes.
How exciting. But I notice you're involved in some organizations. Let me see. There are some signs about conservation group at people's houses or the entries of people's driveway. And I don't know if it's is it this one at Cascabel?
That would be the Natural Resource Conservation Districts. And that is mostly for some of the larger landholders, the ranchers in the area.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of other more local groups, though, that... I would say most of which we're involved in here.
Tell us about some of those. I guess what I'm curious about here, and maybe people at home are as well, is this really growing around the country? That's my sense that it is, that there are more and more people living in maybe containers or various alternative forms of living to get out of the... I just wonder if you're
connected. That's true, and certainly there's a movement toward tiny houses. We read about that frequently. Of course, people often send us articles and things because they see that we're living in a tiny house. But yes, I think there is a certain movement toward that, toward alternatives.
And do you associate with people on that basis? I mean, to fuel each other? How do you learn about how to do all this?
For me, the internet has been a tremendous tool, as it has for many people in, you know, many ways.
Yeah, because dropping out, people say, I'm going to get away from electronics, but it's got its other side, doesn't it? Yeah.
It does. Yeah. It does. And I would not characterize us as Luddites. We're very careful about which technologies we bring into our lives.
Yeah, what's the term you both use?
Appropriate technology.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. I've thought about that a lot since I heard it. Appropriate technology, huh?
Yeah, appropriate to the locale that we're living in, appropriate to the way we want to live, appropriate to the earth. And
so where's your big screen TV?
Right out the window.
So is it a growing group? I mean, these working groups and so on, are they growing? And I noticed you also have community gardens.
Yes.
Can you talk about that as well?
Yes, when we first came here 16 years ago, there were really just a couple of sort of organized groups here. And I would say there's, you know, that's grown to by two or three times in the 16 years we've been here.
Yes, I think I really feel like it is growing very fast these days.
Mm-hmm. Now, here in Cascabel, I would say most of those groups are oriented towards conservation work. This is a really environmentally unique area. We have the greatest diversity of mammal species in the country here.
Hmm. So
we have a lot of what are known as the neotropical. Well, we have a lot of the animals that many of the listeners here, I'm sure, are familiar with.
You don't have giraffes, I know.
We don't have giraffes, no. But we do have mountain lions and bears and bobcats and skunks and rabbits and coyotes. But we also have a lot of animals that people elsewhere in the U.S. are not that familiar with. Coatis, ringtails.
What are coatis? I haven't heard
that. It's in the raccoon family. It looks a little like a cross between a monkey and a raccoon.
Oh, interesting.
And they are very interesting. Fun to watch. And we've got ocelots, jaguars, quite a variety, javelina, a lot of animals that you just don't see elsewhere in the country.
Huh, what about reptiles, snakes? And
lots of them.
Huge.
Really?
Huge variety.
Cascabel means rattlesnake in Spanish.
Does it?
It does.
Oh, seriously, wow. How do you handle that?
Carefully. In the hot months, we are very sort of subconsciously tuned in to the presence of rattlesnakes. Mm. And when we do find them around the house, we used to catch them, put them in a bucket, and take them off. But in the last 10 years or so, we pretty much just leave them be and keep an eye on them. And
talk to them?
Yeah, and they mind their business and we mind ours, and we give each other, you know, a comfortable, a safe berth.
I had no idea you had all that number of animals. That's amazing.
Yes, you know, I think all of us who come here look at this landscape, and it's very much desert, and you think, wow, this probably couldn't support very many animals, but it's the variety is just fantastic, you know, incredible.
Oh, wow.
And the other thing about this valley is that it's actually a living river. The San Pedro River is actually a living river yet, with cottonwood trees and a real riparian area. And it has become the last major migratory flyway for birds coming up from Central and Central America.
What kind of birds do you have? Eagles and so on?
We have, I think, in the neighborhood of 350 or more species have been sighted here.
Wow.
So it's quite a variety. Yeah.
That's a lot.
It's considered an extremely important migratory corridor for the birds that go north and eat the insects that would be destructive of the forests, the northern forests.
Hmm.
So it's really important, even economically, but ecologically, certainly, it's very, very important.
So I know that there have been a lot of meetings and discussions and probably votes about how to conserve the area. Can you talk a bit about that? Is that, like, where are all the subdivisions and you know what I mean? Are there laws against that? Are there people restraining that? Or is there water? Is there aquifer?
We actually have a pretty good supply of water here at this time, but we would not like to think that we will need to support Tucson or the other cities in the area with water.
Okay.
And so far, in our section of the valley, we don't have any major subdivisions. It's very rural, and there are a number of us that would like to keep it that way.
Well, you're actively keeping it that way, are you not? Yes.
Mm-hmm. We are working on trying to figure out some sort of conservation status that could be in place here that would help to keep it from becoming overtaken with subdivisions. But also, it's become a popular route for infrastructure proposals.
Uh-huh.
And so we're also trying to ward off massive power lines and interstate highways, and
because it
looks like a blank spot on the map that would be a good place to run something.
Cell phone towers
unsightly
and
through.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you use a cell phone here?
You can't, and we're very happy about that.
So did you have to fight to keep it like that, or you know what I mean?
We are constantly working on it. There are five, who are all working on trying to keep this major development, whether it be infrastructure or major subdivisions, out of this part of the valley, in order to preserve both the traditional lifestyles and also, increasingly importantly, the natural setting here, the habitat, trying to prevent fragmentation of habitats for all the animals that live here.
And encroach upon their territory.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, what do you recommend for people? How can people become more aware of their own areas? Like, how can people, in different parts of the country, many people are talking like you. They would like to be more of a participant in keeping nature alive, if you will. You know, how can people start working on that? Is there a lot going on in the federal government? Is it active?
I think some of the most promising and engaging areas are local.
Hmm.
It's hard to prescribe where to look in any given area, but a little internet searching, a little asking around, usually doesn't take long to find out who's working on these sorts of things.
And do you create national support groups as well, or do you hook in with them even though it's...
We often hook in with larger conservation organizations, for example, and also with state and federal government.
Hmm.
agencies, be it, you know, game and fish departments, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
So you think it's actually really, I guess I want to hear this. I'm hoping you're going to say that it's moving and growing throughout the country, that people are really looking after.
I mean, I can speak certainly to this community and to a number of others that I know in this part of the country, and it's very definitely growing.
Hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
So I
have the impression that land trusts are growing too.
Good. And land trusts
another
are,
way of yes. of conserving land, putting conservation easements on land to prevent development and.
And having groups of people coming together and pooling their resources to try to purchase lands that are in particular need of conservation.
And that's been happening around here, has it not?
Yes, it has.
Yeah. So I think my friend was saying that 5 different groups got together to purchase the land that she's on for that reason.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Yes,
exactly.
Yeah. So that's really exciting. Yeah. So both of you work some of the time, I mean work in, what would you call them? Real jobs?
Yeah.
I know you work all the time. I know that, you know.
Income producing jobs.
Exactly, right. Yeah.
We figured that we need to work about 1 day a week.
Okay.
In terms of income producing.
In terms of income producing.
Yeah. Oh, that's not
work.
Bad. Yeah. Do you do it here?
I actually, we spend several months of the summer in Oregon. And
it's the reverse of the snowbird, right?
Right.
Yes.
we have dear friends who own a farm up there and have a place that we can go each summer. And I also have a nursing job that I can go back to each summer.
Oh, that's good, eh?
So it works out really well for me to get most of my income-producing work done during the summer months.
So I noticed on your website, which is a really interesting website, we should give the name of it right now, too.
It's omick.net, omick.net.
Omick.net, okay. And I noticed that they said when you're working in the summertime up in the Willamette Valley, you live exactly the same lifestyle, is that right?
Pretty much, yes.
Do you have a small home there as well?
Yes, it's actually smaller than this one.
Oh, really? Did you outfit it as beautifully as this one?
We're pretty happy with it. We think so.
Yeah. That's a real change in climate, isn't it? The Oregon versus this?
It is. During the summer, it's quite beautiful up there. Yeah. We actually get more rain here in the desert during the summer than we get up in Oregon.
Oh, you're kidding.
Where we're at. It's quite surprising.
So you're in the eastern section of Oregon. So.
We're actually in the western section, but it's a Mediterranean climate with cool wet winters and warm, dry summers.
Hmm.
Whereas here in Arizona during the summer, we have a monsoon season.
Oh, right.
So July and August can be fairly rainy here.
Is it similar there? When you go there for the summer, is it similar in terms of people and conservation and wanting to keep track? And it is?
I would say so, yes. Yes. Yeah, we have a, I would say our, the people we associate up with up there tend to be more those who are interested in alternative ways of living, lighter on the land and
smaller footprint.
Smaller footprint. Right.
And also the people who are interested in the appropriate technologies, the composting toilets and the solar oven.
Yeah, right.
How's solar going there?
Well, you're the one that does solar.
Yeah, it's increasing rapidly everywhere,
right.
And not just everywhere in the country, but really everywhere in the world.
Yeah, I've been kind of intrigued that Germany is one of the.
Yes.
And you know they don't have a great weather system, do they? You know?
Right.
No.
Yeah. Surprisingly, and quite a few people in Oregon do use solar, despite the fact that their climate is not that conducive.
Yeah, well, just hearing about Germany, you go, well, we have no excuse in the Northwest, do we?
Quite true.
And David, don't you consult with people about all this kind of stuff?
I do. My primary work is what a friend of mine refers to as sustainable system design.
Mm-hmm.
And that covers anything from designing and building tiny houses to designing and building composting toilets, rainwater catchment systems, solar electric systems, all the systems we use on a daily basis here.
And I noticed your website has a fairly good description of how to do how a composting toilet looks, or you have all these different aspects of what it is you're doing.
Yeah, one of the things we've really tried to focus on over the years is to try to make a lot of what we do here more accessible to mm-hmm. other people, to try to simplify it to the point where other people can look at it and say, oh, you know, I could do that.
So people bring tours through?
We get a lot of college groups coming through here.
Yeah. And is that how you teach them how to do it, or where do you teach them?
I would say a lot of it is through our website. some of it is when we get groups in.
And David's also affiliated with an organization in Tucson called Watershed Management Group.
Oh.
And he's been involved with them in education, teaching workshops, and building composting toilets.
Yeah, people should be in touch with you for more information, too, about that.
I'm always happy to talk about it.
Well, it's really exciting.
I'm known locally as the toilet man.
Oh, you are? Well, that's not a bad thing, eh? The toilet cycle, yeah. Talk about how you went from sailboats into such a dry area, too.
Well, I actually grew up about 100 miles from here, so in a pretty arid climate, over in Silver City, New Mexico.
Still interesting you went off on sailboats.
Yes, and that came about out of high school. I made a trip up to Alaska, and along the coast of southeast Alaska, I just fell in love with that coastline and wanted to go back. I was on the ferry and wanted to go back at my own pace, so I built a sailboat and sailed up there, and that was really my introduction to sailing. But it taught me that...
But you kind of lived on sailboats some of the time, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, many, many, many months.
Did you go all over the world?
Let's see. Well, I sailed to Alaska, Hawaii, virtually all of the coast of Mexico.
Wow. So you're kind of, you call yourself a survivalist? It's more than that, a survival adventurist.
I would say much more adventurous than survivalist, yeah. Survivalist doesn't really resonate so much, but I do enjoy periodic adventures, and fortunately so does Pearl very much.
That's really exciting. So did you learn about, I don't know, solar on sailboats? Are they using solar on sailboats
and that sort of thing? Very much, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I think one of the biggest things for me was just an orientation toward smaller living spaces, and when I got back to more living on land, I also realized that living more simply really resonated with one of my core values, which is freedom.
Hmm.
Pearl mentioned earlier that we only work for income about one day a week.
Mm.
And part of the reason we can do that is that materially at least, we live pretty simply. And we really pay attention to the expense side of the home economy equation, not just the income side.
Living simply, it means a lot more when you say it than a lot of us. Yeah, because everything is constructed to work in sync with the, you know, so where is it all going? Where is it going on our planet?
Hopefully it's moving towards a greater awareness that as we see in nature, everything is connected, and we are all very much connected to what's happening everywhere in the world. We can't really know more than a pretty local area really well, but we do know that we're all connected.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that awareness is increasing. I hope it is.
Well, it's called life and death and that sort of thing, because it is.
That's right.
Yeah.
What about the indigenous people? Have you had any, you know, being connected? Are you connected with any of their systems and so on? Their style is not the same, I don't think. But anyway, I just wondered if you were any in association with them.
Not so much here. We probably would be if we lived further down the valley. That's much closer to the San Carlos Apache Reservation. But here, we're fairly removed from that. We're about 75 miles north of the Mexican border, so we don't have a lot of the Hispanic influence here either, which at other times in our lives we have had more, and we kind of miss it sometimes.
Right.
I was just thinking that their thing is they often talk about being linked with the earth more than we are.
Right.
Yeah.
That resonates for sure.
Yeah. So you said, so where from here? You're going to stay here for how long? Are you going to stay here forever, do you think?
That's a hard one to answer.
Yeah, we try to keep our options open. Mm-hmm. That's part of the freedom.
I think that's one of our values also, is flexibility.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, that's huge. Yeah.
And enthusiasm. Also, your gardens. Yeah. Your gardens are really interesting, aren't they? I mean, do you try to, can you create all your own food? Or?
We certainly don't create all our own food, but we get, during certain seasons at least, we get most of our vegetables from our gardens.
Good.
Mm-hmm. We have a garden both in Oregon and here, and we have the community garden here, which is really important to us. And
did you create the community garden, you two?
I would say we were strongly instrumental in starting it, but are very grateful that we have a really committed core group of gardeners at this point.
Okay.
But we also, in addition to the vegetables, we've also had an emphasis in our gardens on producing more staple crops than many people would. So, for example,
more staple crops.
Calorie crops.
Okay.
So, for example, in our Oregon garden last year, we produced, how many pounds of beans was that?
It was over 100 pounds of beans,
wow.
Dried pinto beans.
And the community garden has grown quite a bit of wheat,
mm-hmm.
and we have our own grinder, too.
Oh, you have. So you're really trying to do all of it. Mm-hmm. I noticed when I first met you yesterday, finishing with the apples, they were sorting out the trees all along the roadway. I guess they were pruning them and so on, and chipping.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was delightful that you're going, oh, look at all those wood chips. You know I can do something with those. Is it always? It's always a matter of that, isn't it? Not just wood chips, but
an awareness of how things can be used. That's right. And yeah. David is very good at that. You'll notice he was the one that immediately ran over to them.
I know, he had great enthusiasm. But, well, instinctively I went, oh, that's brilliant. I mean, so many of us would walk by. What are you going to do with the chips?
We're going to use them on the asparagus bed in the garden for mulch.
Okay.
And so they'll help to produce food.
Isn't that great? And then they'll be back in the soil, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And it's one more example of taking something that in our society we tend to look on as waste, the wood chips, and instead looking at them in a whole different way as a resource.
And they didn't charge you or object or anything?
They were so happy to be able to dump them because they're always looking for places where they can dump them.
Oh, they are.
They
wonderful,
were,
yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
Really
the other food-related thing that we do that's been sort of unique is encouraging the use of the mesquite pods. Many of the local trees around here are mesquite trees, and it's a legume. They produce a pod that's very nutritious.
Oh, I thought they were poison.
Oh, no.
See what I mean? It's like, that's just like...
No,
it would have been one of the staple foods of the native peoples that lived
here. Oh, really? Okay.
So we determined that a hammer mill was a very useful piece of equipment to break them up into flour.
Oh, okay.
And started a...
What's a hammer mill?
It's a mill that pulverizes the pods. It's about the only type of mill that will work for the pods because the pods have such a high sugar content that it tends to gum up other kinds of mills. So it's high in protein, high in carbohydrates, and high in sugar.
Wow.
And yes, as Pearl mentioned.
So it's actually can be a complete protein?
I think it's very close to a complete protein.
Huh.
Yeah.
Now, we usually mix it with wheat flour because of the gluten issue. It doesn't mesquite flour doesn't have any gluten in it, so you can't do baking with it the way you can with a gluten product.
But if people are gluten-free or need to be gluten-free, that might be okay.
It would be great food, yeah.
Right, exactly. So we actually were instrumental in purchasing one of these hammer mills, and we make it available a couple days each year for people who want to gather mesquite pods and bring them for milling into flour.
Yeah.
So we have a nice festival day each fall. We grind people's mesquite pods into flour. We serve a mesquite pancake breakfast.
Wow.
And we have a whole local foods.
I've never even heard of mesquite pods being edible. Never. You know, it's very interesting.
We've been quite amazed at how that's taken off. 14 years ago when we first started. Basically, nobody showed up. The next year, a handful of people showed up. And
so what did you hear about mesquite pods? Why did you start it?
I think I'd read about it being one of the staples of the Native Americans, and it was something that, wow, this looks like a real resource here.
And I interrupted you, so you said that only a few people came, and then...
So, yes, and a couple of years ago, we were up to 200 people.
Wow, that's exciting!
Yeah. Oh, we had a band with local music, and demonstrations on how to make mesquite tortillas. And,
oh, wow.
So
they're
wonderful.
Sweet, eh? You think it's
mesquite
pods are sweet?
They are.
Yeah.
So what do you use as a sweetener? What about agave? Do you know how to create that? Is that, I mean, that seems like it should be a
we
local thing.
We use it, but I don't know how to create it. Not yet, at least.
So how sweet is the mesquite pod? Can you use it as a sweetener? Can you...
Some people actually boil liquid down on the pods and make a mesquite syrup.
Wow.
Well.
Have you tasted it?
Yeah, it's quite good.
Mm-hmm. Is it?
It is.
I mean, is it actually sweet or is it?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Yeah, very, very sweet.
Really?
And the pods definitely, even if you just take a pod off the tree and chew on it, it definitely tastes sweet.
Wow.
And the flower is sweet.
Isn't that interesting? That's not something I've ever heard of. So obviously I'm going to have to taste some before I leave this area. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, we'll give you some mesquite flour to take.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah. So what other little local indigenous things? They're not indigenous, I guess, are they? Yeah, they're local.
Well, there's certainly a number of local foods that can be utilized here.
That we won't have heard of, different types of corn or...
It would be, a number of things that can be used in cooked greens and salads, purslane, which grows elsewhere in the country, but a number of types of mustard, amaranth, foods that would have been traditionally used as well.
Hmm. And, of course, the cactus fruits are...
Prickly pear, remember those.
Prickly pear and saguaro.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever eaten any saguaro. Is that...
It's delicious.
It's actually... I feel it's much more tasty than the prickly pear is.
Really?
Other people probably wouldn't agree, but it seems to me in general.
There's a lot of beautiful saguaros around here, isn't there?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you eat meat?
We do eat some meat. We're not strictly vegetarian, although we don't cook with meat very often here at home. Actually, almost never. Very, very rarely.
Hmm.
But if we're served meat when we eat out at someone else's house, we eat it.
So you don't really object to that, yeah. Right. No, boy, you have to be very resourceful. You're always sort of bringing in, like, it's always the internet, I guess, that you're looking for new ideas or.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's an outstanding source. And just talking with other people.
So what's coming up? Is there a festival coming up soon?
Not that I can think of. The mesquite milling happens in the fall, in November.
In November.
And that has really grown over the last 12 to 15 years. As I say, when we started, we were just, almost nobody showed up. And now there are several millings in Tucson.
Oh, really?
Bisbee, Flagstaff, Phoenix, New Mexico, Texas.
Oh, wow.
It's really expanded throughout the mesquite belt.
So you started, did you start it?
Well, we sort of learned afterward that we may have been the first place to, I mean, obviously the Native Americans were the first to really start it, but sort of in the modern era, we may have been, I don't know.
But, funny how this is Johnny Appleseed things just get going.
Yeah.
Isn't that the
that
most
we're
exciting
aware
thing?
Of?
That
it,
right.
Holding community millings the way we did start that. I I've never heard of any of anybody that had started it before we did.
So what about healing? Do you know much about herbs and healing and that sort of thing?
That's an area we could stand to do a lot more learning about.
That's true.
And that may be coming.
Yeah, because there's a lot of, like, local plants and things that it would be good to learn about. Yeah.
That is true.
So you went to, you said that someday you might go back on the water?
I think it's very possible.
Well, actually, we have in a sense.
Well, that's right.
Three summers ago, we did a long kayak trip along the Alaskan coast.
And that was beautiful.
Yes, and we plan to do another one this summer.
That's great. Yeah. Wow, what adventures. This is exciting.
So I guess we've downsized in that respect too, haven't we? From a sailboat to a kayak.
But how do you see, I guess what I'm seeing is like, how does the future look? What's your dream? Do you have a dream of like seeding all this kind of consciousness for people, helping people to wake up to it? Or do you even think about that? And do you write? Do you write about it?
For me, it's more, I think, of following a path, trying to live according to some core values,
uh-huh.
and just letting that go where that's going to go, trying to let go of where it's going to go. And that's not always easy, but because, you read the headlines and so forth, and it is sometimes pretty easy to get discouraged. But
isn't it interesting, very often the headlines or whatever's in the public media doesn't include any of this kind of living.
That,
you know what I mean?
There's
an awful
lot.
My understanding is there are a lot of people wanting to have at least some aspect of the kind of life you're doing.
Yeah.
And I hear wonderful stories of altruism and people sharing and people supporting one another.
Mm-hmm.
They don't ever make the media.
Right.
Yeah, that's not what sells, unfortunately.
Yeah. So it just seems to me, and I could be wrong, that there's a real movement going on here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at all this list of organizations that you've, and in this list, which is a number of them, Cascabel Working Group, Conservation Association, Lower San Pedro Watershed, is that all a community garden? Well, I know there's some overlap here.
There
is it all the same people?
It's a lot of the same people, but not entirely.
Is there anybody in the local government?
From
these organizations, or
there isn't really local government here.
I mean, other than the county.
Okay.
And
right.
And we are certainly in touch with the county frequently about issues. And have a good relationship.
Do they get mad at you?
No, I think we have a pretty good relationship actually with our county supervisor for this district.
Oh, okay.
We're not always happy with what the county does, but I think we have pretty open communication, I would say.
Oh, good. And they're
receptive
to your concepts and your ideas and how you're doing it.
Yeah.
But it looks like a lot of people. And it seems like California's got a lot of stuff like this going on, does it, in the desert parts of California?
I think it does. When I read, for example, right now, one of the things that we're trying, one of the major infrastructure projects we're trying to keep out of the valley is a major power line project.
Okay.
That just, this is not the appropriate place for that. A place with this environmental richness. And so when I read about other places in the country, you mentioned California, that's a lot of it's going on there. I'm always amazed at how many local groups I read about that are coming together to try
protect
the places they love.
I think what's interesting too is what we already talked about, the media and how it kind of bypasses some of this kind of information. But you already said it, little groups, little local groups are growing in number, which builds a huge,
mm-hmm.
you know, infrastructure almost. It's very exciting, isn't it?
It is. I think there's just a lot of empowerment going on in
that too.
Way.
And you don't hear about it in a big way.
No.
So
right.
much. What about, like, when you were talking about the power lines
mm-hmm.
and so on, a lot of this, the delicate balance is really delicate, isn't it?
In the desert, it is.
Yeah.
Definitely. When soil has been disturbed, it takes a long time to recover in the desert environment.
Mm-hmm. And is that the sort of thing that you present? You know, that like what's happening with the power lines? Are you able to back it off, or are they arguing with you?
We have been successful in delaying it substantially,
okay.
And this has actually cost the company that's proposing this power line a number of their key investors. And the project is looking like it's on pretty shaky financial ground at this point. And
oh, good, because the investors are supporting you.
Exactly, and
wow.
their major investor has left.
Wow.
And,
now, that's amazing, because usually it's the moneyed interest that we expect is going to create the problem, right?
Yeah. And I think it's one of the ways that local groups can become empowered to enable this kind of change by following where the money's going. And in this case for us, it was to the investors, well, to the company that was proposing this power line, and also to the major investors. And I think the message was getting back to them. I don't think it's the only reason they pulled out, but I think it was a major one, that the message was getting back that this project was really getting slowed down and was running into serious problems. And
so did the major investors then come to support you people?
No. We wish that cycle had completed.
Yeah. I guess that's asking a little bit too much, you know. So it looks like you'll offset that one, though, hey? So far, or delay, as you said.
We'll see.
We'll see. I would give it 50-50 at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But
where's it going to run? Because are you getting, you seem to be getting some support from other parts of other states.
It would be running basically right up the valley for 45 miles here.
Oh.
And it would be one of the largest transmission projects in the country. Yeah, these would be massive lines.
So we definitely have support from a number of groups in Tucson, which has been very helpful.
Well, as an intuitive, I just see that you also have some a little farther west.
Yes.
Yeah, there's some, they might not be actually on the power line, but there's some clout coming up from people.
Yeah, and we've also got, a working relationship with a number of national environmental organizations that recognize the value of this area.
Mm-hmm.
This is, in this case here, it is really not at the core a NIMBY issue. This is an issue about a real environmental treasure in this country that could very well go by the wayside if all it would really take is one major infrastructure project coming through here, and it tends to open a gateway for a lot of others. And
it looks like some people with some clout know that, and
yes.
I think you're going to get a lot of help with that, you know. So let's refer back to your website and give everybody ways of contacting both of you. I've really enjoyed this, but you've made me think a lot. I'm going, I have to go back home. Because I'm from Bellingham, where they call themselves the sustainability capital, whatever that means, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't been as involved as maybe we'll start getting. But it's helped me a lot to hear, how much you've learned.
It causes us to think, to have to answer the questions.
Yeah.
And that's good. That's good.
It is. It's a really, really important commitment. It's a beingness. It's a being commitment that you've both made, and it's really beautiful too. It's wonderful. So talk about your website and leave everybody with a way to get in touch with you.
The website is omic.net, O-M-I-C-K.
And that's David's name, right?
Net.
Yes.
.net. And David's email address is on that website, and he always welcomes emails from people who are interested.
And when you're up, for people who want to see what's going on, this is down near Benson. Is that a good way to describe it?
That's
right. This is east of Tucson?
That's right. About 30 miles east of Tucson in southeastern Arizona in the San Pedro River Valley. Yes, each morning when I wake up, I make a cup of coffee and spend a couple hours answering emails. And
good for
you. I always enjoy that part of my day. Yeah.
Good for you. And then up in the Willamette Valley?
Mm-hmm.
So in the summertime, people who wanted to be in touch with you in that area and maybe find out what you're doing, I think it would be nice for them to know.
And they can email there as well.
Right.
And David is very prompt about answering in general.
Unless we're off on an adventure.
Which is allowed, you know.
Which could be a good bit of this coming summer.
Right.
A while back, I interviewed a fellow, Kelly Hart, who does alternative home construction, all sustainability and so on. Anyway, he finally retired and he lives in Mexico, but he's handling a website. And the last time I talked to him, he said he was getting like 30,000 hits a day.
Wow.
Because people want to know.
Yeah, there's a real hunger.
A hunger for what you're doing. There's a hunger for that power that we have to be in sync with all that is, or the connection.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So thank you so much, Pearl, and thank you, David.
Thank you.
Thank
Pleasure
you.
To be here.
Good night and many blessings.